is very similar to the kind of things that we've been looking at week by week previously. And by that I mean this. What tends to happen in these sections is that the beginning of the section identifies a human failing, a human foible, a weakness in human beings, what we do, how we live our lives. And then it presents the remedy, it presents a solution. What happens now? So here you are, you've done this. This is what you need to do to put it right. So it reveals the weaknesses and the flaws in people's lives, and then it spells out a corrective process of putting people right with God, back in their own, so restoring their own peace, the peace of their own consciences, and putting them right with God. So really it charts what happens in all of our lives, which is this instance where we drift from God for whatever reason. The Bible says we're born in sin, so it's something we all experience. And then in consequence of that, we come in and out of closer fellowship with God, but we're being brought back to the Lord, and this is how it's to be done. The passage we've been looking at, these first seven verses, is an example of that. What we've got there in the first three verses really spells it out, this whole idea that people are being deceitful, they're being unfaithful to the Lord, they're not taking care of things that they've been given to look after, lost property. If you wanted to kind of put all those things under one heading, I suppose what it says there is, you know, people break each other's trust. Trust breaks down amongst people. It's, you know, I don't really need to say too much more to know we've all had a measure of experience of this, haven't we? Trust breaks down. And it's one of the great evils, actually, isn't it? These breaches of trust. It releases all sorts of unhappiness and misery into the world. But then the restorative process, verses 4 and 5, having talked about these breaches of trust, then it goes on to say, well, what are we going to do about it? You've got to make restitution. You've got to put it all back. And it's not enough just to put it all back. You've got to put it back. You've got to. It's quite interesting the way that the man who's been offended has got to get the restitution made to him personally. It's not enough just to put it in an envelope and send it to that person. You've got to go and stand in front of the person who you've offended, and you've got to give it to that man face to face in the presence of God in the holy place. Before God and the person you've offended, put it right. You've got to put this thing right. And it's not enough just to put it right. There is a further penalty added to that as well, isn't there? In verses 6 and 7, having just made restoration and acknowledged before God and acknowledged before the person you've sinned against, what you've done and putting it right, then there's also a penalty to be paid. There's punishment, if you will, added to that for having begun the whole process in the first place. But the good news is that if you're being prepared to do those things, and they are painful things, aren't they? They're difficult things to do. That at the end of verse 7, you will be forgiven. And that's a wonderful word. That is a wonderful word. That means it's over, doesn't it? That means no, the person who's been offended can't go to God and say, oh, he did this. No, it's been forgiven. You don't reproach yourself, I did this. No, it's been forgiven. It's forgiven. It's over. We're moving on. And that's wonderful, isn't it? Because that means that what's been broken has been fixed, and there's a new start. There's a new day. There's new life. Praise the Lord. It's good stuff. So this is the sort of the pattern that we see here all the way through the book of Leviticus up until this point. I don't know if you've all picked up on this. Have you, any of you following the Levinson inquiry a little bit on the news? Just shake your head if you have, or acknowledge if you have a little bit what's been going on. Okay, but they've been talking about this a lot recently. The judiciary are talking about this. And it's because of this. Levinson was sent to do an inquiry into the press, right? The phone hacking scandal and all this sort of thing, right? Okay? And the police to find, because there was some complicity going on there. And the politicians, who it turns out also had their fingers in the pie. So the media, the police, you know, the politicians, somehow they're all mixed up in this, and this inquiry has gone into place. And one of the things he's proposing is that it's not enough that if I am the newspaper and I take your story and I hack into your mail account and I make it my news story. You can sue me and I have to make restoration to you. But you know what? You may have lost £1 million worth of damages in the consequence of what's happened to you. And I can give you that £1 million back. But I've made £5 million from selling newspapers and I've still made a profit from your misery. So Levinson's saying it's not enough just to make restitution. You have to be punished. You have to be punished in such a way that it does not pay. That whatever profit you've made, you have to forego those things, and so that in the end, crime does not pay. And there's a lot of big hoo-ha about this, because now you're punishing people. You're punishing people. But, well, we'll see how it all works out. But what I know is, when I see this pattern being worked out here in the book of Leviticus, I see people doing all manner of things, and then being got a hold of and brought to book about those things, made to fulfill their responsibilities to each other and to God, and that more than that, they are punished and taught a lesson to make sure they think twice about doing something like that again. And that is the process that we're being given here in this passage here. It's like a rugby ref. I like rugby. I've kind of gone off football because I don't like rugby. Football refs are great, but nobody listens to them. But in rugby, they actually listen to the ref. If he says, whistle blows, everybody stops. If it's a penalty and you going off the thing, you would go off. There's no argument. Two men brawling and fighting. He says, say sorry to each other and shake hands. They do. Right? And it's a good game as a result. You just get on with it rather than all this theatrics. Right? And I see something like this. This isn't rough justice, but it is real justice. It's proper justice. It's functional. It's lively. It's got energy to it. And you get the feeling that at the end, you get to the place you want to be. Because in the previous chapters we've been looking at, we've been seeing people's willful disobedience against God. I mean, that's what we're talking about in the sin chapters here. People know exactly what they're doing, and they still go out and do it. And some of the things people do, I included myself, I'm a person, by the way, you know, some of the things people do. And in addition to that, we've been looking at that. Then we sort of looked at the ignorance, people's ignorance, and the things that people do in their ignorance. Ignorance is a terrible thing, isn't it? You know, the things that people do in their ignorance, out of their stupidity, out of their lack of knowledge, the misery that is unleashed as a consequence of these things. That's what we've been looking at. And not only that, you know, it's one thing to disobey the laws of the land, knowingly disobey the laws of this land, and knowingly or being ignorant of the laws of this land. The laws that we're talking about here in Leviticus are God's laws. You know, they have a divine sanction to them. So these rebellions and this ignorance is not just human ignorance and rebellion against rules. It's an out-and-out rebellion and rejection of God. It's grievous stuff. It's grievous, grievous stuff. So you, in that context, you need a good, firm solution, don't you? A good, firm solution. Breach of trust. Breach of trust. It rips communities apart, doesn't it? It rips families apart. It rips societies apart. It's such toxic stuff. And I think if you and I look around us in this community, in the society that we're living in, breach of trust is causing mayhem all over the place. People complain, don't they? When I'm talking to older people about what they think is wrong with what's going on today, 90% of what they have to say to me is the way that communities have broken down, how trust has broken down, respect has broken down. That's their observation. That's one of the things that they are talking about. Let's not put a sugar coating on the past, but that is their observations of what's been seen. And we need help. We need a solution to this, because the trajectory, the breakdown of society, you only have to see in some parts of society, in some parts of some communities, some no-go areas where just it becomes, life becomes impossible. Nigh on impossible. Nobody can trust anybody. Nobody can walk down the street. Everybody's watching their back. Everybody's afraid. You know, it's a recipe for disaster. Just for a minute, fraud. Let's just talk about fraud, because it's talking about breach. There's a breach of trust, fraud. Do you know how much fraud is costing this country, what the fraud bill every year in this country is? And we want to... This is my... I always do this, don't I? You're kind of higher, lower. How much is fraud costing us? How much are people ripping us off for every single year in this country? 5% of GDP. Do you want to put a figure to that? Okay, fine. Well, that's a pretty irrelevant figure then, isn't it? Thank you for making an effort, though, Roy. Appreciate that. £38 billion a year. Okay? Nearly face. You see, you shouldn't be so quiet, Stuart, sitting there. Normally you're making a noise. One time you should make a noise. Come on. Let us have it. £12 billion is scams. You know? All the scams. Has anybody met the scams yet? We get bombarded with scams, don't we? £4 billion of those scams is just from private individuals, the little yous and me. £4 billion. Now, I did the maths on that, and I'm not very good at maths, but I worked out. That means somebody is taking £70 out of every man, woman, and child's back pocket every single year. If you broke down that £4 billion between the number of us, that's 70 quid out of yours and my pocket. That hurts. That's just the £4 billion, not the £38 billion costing business and government. We have a really big problem on our hands. I don't want to... Imagine somebody put it in your hand in your pocket to try and take 70 quid. Really. Then let's talk about robbery. Because this is mentioned here. Robberies. There are 6,000 domestic robberies, right, a month. There are 26,000 robberies from shops and office premises, and a further 60,000 robberies from vehicles and other places. That's 100,000 robberies a month in this country. People robbing each other, stealing from each other. That's shocking figures, isn't it? That means that one in 50 of us each year is likely to experience a robbery. I've been robbed this year. I've been burgled this year within the last 6 months. And we're out in lovely rural Wiltshire, where nothing much happens, right? Not so. There's like a gang. If I worked out the figures, there's a gang of like 300 people active in this country who every single day are committing a crime. There's this gang of them, 300, just going every single day, break this window, going around stealing. Honesty's under attack, isn't it? In America, this is America, 25 to 40% of people who made an application for a job admitted they lied through their teeth in their job applications. There are huge numbers of people in jobs they're not qualified to do, that they've been disallowed from practicing in, and they're out there driving cars, delivering stuff, taking receipt of goods that they have no right to do. They've lied through their teeth. In fact, university graduates in America, 95% of college graduates in America said they would lie to get a job. And 41% had said they'd already done so. It doesn't breed confidence, does it? It doesn't breed trust. So, it seems to be getting worse. The figures, 1997 figure said 38% of people had got their job through lying. And I think in the previous 10 years, it was only 18%. But I wondered if that's because 20 years ago, people lied about lying, whereas now they tell the truth about lying. I'm not quite sure what the difference is. But all I know is that people are lying, and they're cheating, and they're thieving, and they're breaking down the foundations of trust amongst their brothers and sisters, right? The people who live around them. Verse 3, I just love the way it says that in verse 3. Or when they sin, becomes guilty, sorry, and finds lost property and lies about and swears fault, or commits any such sin that people do. The things that people do. The things that people do. I'm almost like, you know, I keep thinking I've now become bombproof. I am now shockproof. I've heard it now. I've heard it all. Some of the things people do. I think I've heard it all. And then I hear something else. You know, where did they dream it up? It's like a factory producing this stuff, this toxic stuff. And I mean, just like, you know, all this lying, stealing, and cheating we're talking about. When the that gang went onto the runway, and wasn't it good? They weren't terrorists; just they were just stealing diamonds. They could have been a terrorist gang, couldn't they? Just cut through the fence and in they went. I heard the next day on the radio a group of people being interviewed on the radio about, I wonder how long it's going to be until the film comes out and the book comes out. It's going to be glamorized with film stars playing the thieves within the year, I should imagine. You just wonder, how on earth are we going to make any progress? If any time somebody comes and does anything wrong, they get a book made out of them. I'm not trying to paint too black a picture, but that's what these things are dealing with. This is what these laws are in there to try and address an attack. But who on earth's going to do it? Who's going to take it on? Who's going to take on this mountain? Right? Who's going to climb this, conquer this mountain? This is the question we need to ask ourselves. And we are not going to just write ourselves a cushy check and say the Lord. Okay? Who are the referees? Who's going to be on the pitch? Who's going to be bringing reconciliation between God and man and man when they sin against each other? Who's going to do the work? I think this is what this next section of the chapter begins to deal with. Because the truth is, what we do is we look to the judiciary, or we look to the police, and we look to the media to expose wrongdoing. But the public confidence in these services is in a terrible state. It's in a terrible state. So you say, well, let's look to the community, let's look to the people. But you know what some communities like. It's in a terrible state. Because bottom line, the culture, there's something in the culture. I'm not trying to be whinge here tonight. But there's a cultural problem. So people say, well, what we need is education. Get young people, educate people. But despite all these things, somehow we're still in the place that we're in. Even though people know the answers. In the 18th century, society was in a terrible, terrible state. And people were trying to do all sorts of things. In the end, the solution came that changed the course of British history from the most surprising and remarkable place. It came from God's people. It came from churches and chapels up and down the country. Revival broke out in Britain in the 1800s. And all the social ills that people thought were trying to solve by politics and policies and all these sort of things, actually the Lord just got hold of huge numbers of people's hearts and lives. And that transformed British society and just put a sort of a hindrance and a backstop on the worst abuses of sin. Does anybody in this country really think the church is the solution to the problems in society today? If you took a poll of 100 people, how many people do you think would say, would you think one person would say the answer is the church? Because in the main, they see this megalithic establishment, this body, don't they, of the poor little chattering Christians, right? Okay. But if the God of the church moves through the church and the people of God are filled with the Spirit, that's a very different proposition. And that's what happened in the 18th century. And it's happened at different times in different parts of the world. And God does it. He gets hold of his people. And the wonderful thing about his people is that they are in the judiciary and they're in the police and they're in the media and they're in culture and they're in education and their mothers and their fathers and their sons and their daughters and school children. And they're all sorts of people from every single corner and walk of life. And they are indeed like salt. That's what Jesus talked about. They talked about salt and light. They're just scattered through the world, strategically placed in all the right places. And that's what God needs. That's what God wants, isn't it? There are people who are making a difference all over the place. Little differences all over the place. And I think that's the difference between the wheels falling off this thing and staying on. And I thank God that he has granted this country, that his people, there are his people in this country. I really do. Verse 8. We turn to this because that's what I'm saying. It kind of like moves from the subject of the things that people do to the people who get out there and do something about it. The people who get stuck in. Because it starts to talk to us about the priesthood, about the priests. They're the people that God put in to Israel to be the arbiters, to bring man and God together, to be the go-betweens. Do you know that phrase, to lead somebody to the Lord? You know, when you take somebody in their broken relationships and their broken relationship with God, and you take them by the hand, and by the grace of God, you lead them to Christ, and their peace and their redemption, they start to work it all out. People leading people to the Lord in all manner of places. That is the hope. That's the hope. That is the hope. And God set such a people even from ancient times in Israel. The details we have about them in this passage might seem a little bit scant, might seem a little bit obscure, but I think they're insightful. They tell us useful things about what we need to be. The things that we're told here in this passage talk about their clothing, talk about the kind of work they do, talk about their diet, what they eat, and the kind of discipline they keep. And I'm basically not going to tell you all by the end of this that you've got to wear white linen clothes, okay? Just rest assured at this point. But verses 8 through to 11, you can see there's this little concentration there in those verses about the kind of clothing they wear, their outer garments, their undergarments, their indoor clothes, their outdoor clothes. And then verses 9 and 13, in terms of their activity, there's you notice the tone, this fire that needs to be kept burning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every week of the month, every month of the year, every year in the decade, keeping the fire burning. They've got to do it all the time, keeping the fire burning. And then verses 14 to 30, mostly the concentration of that is on their diet, the things that they eat. But quite interesting, and especially when it's talking to a group of men, they have to wash up afterwards. Did you notice that? They've got to wash up all the pans and make sure it's all kept clean and wash their own clothes. You see, there's a God in heaven. And there are two verses as well, verse 23 and 30, which deal with what happens when the priests go wrong. What will happen when the priests don't do what they're supposed to do? So the concentration is on this group of people. Here's this group of people who are to live in the community, although their life and their activity is hidden behind the curtain. They've got a hidden life that the world can't see behind the curtain in the holy place. But their ordinary everyday lives take place out there amongst everybody else. I hope this has some resonance with you. I hope this you can see the application to your lives. In Numbers, it's quite interesting. Numbers chapter 1, verse 53, it describes the tent of the priests, all their habitations, were encircling around the temple. So in the very center of their... So all their tents were laid out, and in the center of their community was the temple, the place of worship. And around that place was all where the priests had their habitation. So, in other words, if you wanted to get to God, you had to go through the priests. They became your intermediaries. Out there amongst the people, making contact with the people, but never losing touch with God at the same time. Close to him and close to them. It's almost there's something about like the God and man, isn't there? That's why we need Jesus. Fully God, fully man. People within a people, keeping people, bringing people to the Lord. It's kind of queer, kind of, you might say, a bit quaint in verse 10 that we end up talking about their underwear, the fact they're going to wear underwear. I don't want to be profane about this in any way, but that's what it says. It actually focuses, it draws our attention to this detail. But it's actually quite important. And I think I'll tell you why. It talks about their interior clothes, their out clothes, their undergarments. Because that wasn't common. That's not what ordinary people do. They didn't normally have underwear and overgarments. They didn't normally have inside clothes and outside clothes. They had their outside clothes that they wore for everything. These people were different. They took more care. They had to take more care. They had to be more thoughtful, more considerate. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 talks about the body having presentable parts and unpresentable parts. And that the presentable parts don't need special modesty or care, but there are unpresentable parts of our body that do need special care and attention. Modesty. I think that's really what that verse in Corinthians is all about, that people need to be modest. They need to be aware of themselves. And not draw undue attention to those parts of themselves that are unhelpful. To be modest. And I know that through the years, ideas of modesty have changed. But but when you get into 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 9, and it's unfair to concentrate on women's clothing and how women dress, and it's very common and easy of us men to sort of talk about, oh, the way women dress and stuff like that. This is for everybody. This is for everybody. That we dress in such a way that we are can be respected, that we're respectable, and we're not drawing undue attention to ourselves, and we're not showing off, because actually in the end it's not about us. If we're really going to live for the Lord, we really do need to live for Him. And that's the emphasis, that's the focus, that's what we want people to be aware of. There are a degree of modesty about things. Because I know that when you're just drawing attention to yourself all the time, drawing attention to yourself all the time, trying to attract people to yourself, because you can't help anybody, you can't save anybody, you know, you can't do it. But if you can lead somebody to the Lord, if you can lead somebody to the Lord, and you're prepared to step out of the way and not be the big cheese and be the big noise and give Him the glory and the praise, Jesus helps people. Jesus saves people's souls. Jesus can take somebody from the depths of sin and take them all the way to heaven. You can't do that, because He's great. He's glorious. He's God. And that's where we need the emphasis to be. They've got these inside-outside clothes as well, verses 10 and 11. And I think the importance of that is that, you know, you Christians, you've got a wonderful and remarkable relationship with God. And we have to be careful how we manage that in some sort of way. We can't be overly showy about our relationship with God. I was reading in Revelation chapter 7 and verse 13 that the saints wear these white garments. Have you ever read that? Where they wear, we wear white. As far as when the Lord looks at us, we wear white, clean. Right? And the bizarre phrasing of it, because they've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. You'd think that would make them red, wouldn't you? But isn't it remarkable that through the washing of the blood of the Lamb, we are cleansed and made clean? Now, walking around, how many of you would tomorrow put on a pristine white linen suit, linen shirts, white shoes, the works, and go to town? Do you think that would make you a little bit conspicuous? Right? Make you stand. How you feel doing that? Okay? But that's how you approach the Lord. That's how the Lord sees you. You can be in all your glory, in all your finery before Him, because you're washed. It's through Him, isn't it? But I wouldn't go around when I go out into the world. When you come to pray, you've got to be wearing white, right? You have to come before the Lord like that. You have to come, I'm clothed in righteousness, I'm clothed with your blood, I thank you for what you've done for me, I'm not worthy in and of myself to come and pray. Hear me for Christ's sake, hear me for the sake of what He's done for me, for the cleansing that He's given me. But I don't go around like that, talking to people out there like that at all. On the contrary, I have to show them that I'm just one of them. I'm just an ordinary person. And they're changing their clothes, depending on whether they're in the temple, in the presence of the Lord, serving the Lord, praying, being part of the atoning work, or whether they're out there carrying just the dust and the remnants of all that's been done out to the dung heap somewhere to put it all away and mixing with people, ordinarily speaking. We don't go parading ourselves before the world. You've got to stay humble. If we're going to be salt and light, if you want people to listen to you, yeah, we have to be modest. And that means in personal modesty. We have to be personally modest, not just our clothes. You've got to be an approachable sort of person, don't you? Not a 6 foot above contradiction and looking down the long nose of self-righteousness. You've got to humble yourself. And then there's the fire they've got to keep going. Help me, Lord. I know that this fire they kept going, we read about in verse 9 and verse 13. Maybe I should just leave it there and we'll do that another time. I don't know. Should we just do the fire? I think we should keep the fire burning, don't we? Let's do that. They're given this responsibility. These hardworking, modest people are given a remarkable responsibility. And we read about it in verse 9, and we read about it again in verse 13. They're given a fire. The troubled kids, if you give them a fire to look after, they'll be out there all afternoon. They won't give you any trouble at all. You know that, don't you? It's a great thing, isn't it, just looking after a fire, tending the fire. And these people, They're given a responsibility. Look after the fire. Don't let the fire go out. Don't let the fire go out. Right? So they're given this fire to look after. I know there was a lot of them, and they maintained it by rota. And I think talking to us as Christians today is something that we have to do together. We have to make sure that we're all playing our part, and we do this together. Whatever we do, we must not let the fire go out. Right? And you know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the fire. They're talking about, I mean, I love the fact that right now we tend to leave the porch light on. I know it costs us a couple of pounds, right? But there's that red cross on the inside of the glass. And as you drive past the church now, there's this sort of sign projecting. I'm not a big fan of neon signs. But I'm glad that some way, shape or form, we're sort of projecting out 24/7. There's a sort of a sign. There's a sign. I'm glad that on our internet, these sermons and stuff that gets recorded gets put online, that actually anybody wakes up in the middle of the night and is distressed and in some concern and can't sleep and restless in their soul, could, if they wanted to, go to the internet and they could go and hear the gospel being preached to them. And if they believed on him who we preach, they will be saved. That is good news. So that the fire is sort of all is being kept going. I'm glad that we're maintaining a witness. I'm glad we meet morning, evening. I'm glad we do all these sorts of things. Because we've got an eternal fire to keep putting logs on. We've got to keep throwing a log on the fire, haven't we? And keeping it burning. When in the book of Acts, the Holy Spirit came on the people, you know the form that it came in. It came like tongues of fire. It energized them, made them lively. And when that fire started to go out, because Christians have a hard time, and so they come to God and then they pray and they ask him to give them what? Boldness. And the Lord sends the Holy Spirit again and it re-energizes their confession and their demonstration of Christ. They're keeping the fire burning, aren't they? They're making Christ known. They're stoking it up. They're stirring it up inside them. Because as long as that fire burns, and in the daytime, you know the expression, in the daytime there'd be the smoke by day and the fire by night. So like wherever you stood, you'd see this pillar of smoke going up, and you'd say, there is a place where I can turn. There is one to whom I can go. There is a place of forgiveness. There is a place of cleansing. I can be put right with my brother. I can be put right with God. And if it's the night time, there'd be a light shining in the midst of their community. Wherever you stood, you'd see this bright glow. You know what it's like when you look over. Remember, right here, sometimes you can see Coventry, can't you? You can see right up to the Midlands. If you go up high, in the night time, you can see the glow of the lights. My dad said that he was in Cambridge or somewhere around there when the firebombs fell on Coventry, you know, the incendiary devices fell on Coventry, and you could see it from Cambridgeshire. And in Israel, at that time, with the fire burning there in the heart of the temple all the time, you could always see the light. The light is always shining. It's always burning. So that whoever you are, wherever you are, you know there's someone you can turn to. You can get help. You can turn to God. He will hear you. He will pray. There will be somebody there to take your ram, take your offering, take your sacrifices, to bring people together. It's kind of an emergency service, really, isn't it? 24/7, keeping the fire burning. So that, you know, I thank God for the fire service. I thank God for the police. I thank God for all the services and nurses and doctors and all. They're all wonderful people. But in the end, we're all going to die one way or the other. But you get yourself right with God. When that time comes, you're going to heaven. And that is the most important thing in the world. And people can gainsay me there all their life. It's been given to a modest, hard-working group of people to consistently make sure that the good news of Jesus Christ is available to people anytime, anywhere, everywhere, all around the world, in every language. So the knowledge of God. So these are some of the things. I'm going to come to the rest of it later. It's late. But thank you for your attention. And I hope you're encouraged just to be ordinary, modest, approachable, easygoing people with a holy mission, which is really precious. You're the people of God, scattered amongst the peoples, and you can lead people to the Lord. And on the last day, there will be an account.
The scrolls will be open. The records will be, the books will be open. Your names, your deeds will be there. Nothing will be lost. The Lord's eye runs out throughout the whole earth. He misses nothing. The least things that we do, the glass of water we offer in the name of the Lord, nothing is missed in this, our most holy responsibility and service.